We're pleased to be joined by our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book is Meatheads Say the Realest Things. It's available everywhere fine books are sold. Hello there, Colin.
Richard Bartholomew Kimball. How's it going? Did I get it right?
No Bartholomew, though I like that. That would be, I'd feel pretty damn good if my middle name were Bartholomew.
Jesus?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, 1 for 2, baby. 500.
No, my middle name is Guy.
Really?
Which was my grandfather's name. And this is how bad it is. Until I posted something about that on social media, you know, a couple of weeks ago, some weird thing people were doing. And I, it never occurred to me in 62 years of life, because I was born Richard Guy Kimball, it never occurred to me that I was Rich Guy Kimball.
Also, you're doing the gendering, so I have news for you. You are sexist.
that's who I am. I am what I am, Colin, and I am a rich guy. What can I say? We can do whatever we want in America.
There it is.
There you go. Well, so much to talk about today. Let's begin with a great movie and one of my favorite actors, because he just always disappears into a role. 1949's The Setup with the great Robert Ryan.
Interesting you should say that, because I think he tends to do the opposite and doesn't disappear into a role and sort of overshadows the films he's in, especially if he's carrying a film. Like, a lot of little Robert Ryan goes a long way, I would say. But this film, I think, is a bit different because he is underplaying in this movie, I would say, The Setup. And I just think it's one of the two or three best sports films ever made. Like, I watched it again over the weekend or thereabouts, and its unity of action and place and that whole notion of cohesion that Aristotle was talking about is realized in this. It's not one set. Well, it is one set, but like, you move from like building to building, but everything takes place within like a city block, within 2, 3, 4 hours, whatever it is, for a night at the fights.
And it's realistic, which is always a good characteristic of a sports movie. And part of that's because apparently Ryan had some boxing experience back when he was in college.
The actual setup of The Setup is fantastic because he's with his wife and he's 35 and he's punch drunk after all of these years on the road in these hank towns. And they're in, ironically enough, sure you noticed this, Paradise City. This is before Guns N' Roses. It's like very on the thematic nose with that. And the cheap hotel he's staying at with his wife is across the street from the boxing arena. And I like how the windows of the locker room at the boxing arena are opened in such a way that he can look out, because his wife wants him to give this up. She doesn't want him doing this anymore. And he's given her his ticket to come and watch him get his brains cudgeled in all likelihood. But he's weirdly confident. Like, you can tell from the way he tells her, I'm going to win tonight. I think I can take this kid. But that's not just him blowing smoke. Like, he doesn't say that all the time. He actually has some reason to believe that he's going to beat this younger and faster and healthier, especially healthier, all of that, fighter. And so I thought the locker room scene, so it's this multiple bill. It's just fight after fight after fight. And Robert Ryan's character has to fight last, not because he's the marquee guy, but because of the radio audience. They want the radio fight to go out nationally, or probably not nationally, but like regionally at a certain time. And so then after everyone's done, there's like this last fight. People, like the MC is like, oh, don't go home, you can stay. So you get this fantastic locker room talk, though. I think it's the most realistic locker room talk in any sports film of any kind. You think a hockey film maybe would carry the banner for this, but I think it's the most realistic locker room talk ever in any sports movie.
And I also like the fact that there's an element of real time that takes place in the movie.
Oh, yeah. That's just such a key part of this film. It's not like, strictly speaking, real time because you have all these fights to get through, but it feels like it's actually taking place in real time. So, like, he can walk from the hotel to this place, his wife leaves the hotel, she's about to go into the arena, decides not to, takes a walk to a bridge, tears up her ticket, and it's all within, like, this city block. It's really this perfect sort of setting for this film, and then out to the actual boxing arena itself where they're going to have these fights. So he's this sort of wise sage, and he's giving advice to these other guys, and other guys are just like dreaming. They're fooling themselves. One guy's like, oh, I'm going to do this, and they all know it's like you're going to be lucky to get back here within an inch of your life. Sure enough, that happens, and there's like this young guy on the rise and all of this, and he's supposed to throw this fight, but his manager and trainer have so little confidence in his pugilistic prowess that they don't tell him. Like, he'll be bothered. And they just think he's so bad that he's going to lose anyway. So they're telling him, like, oh, just go into your shell. Maybe, like, you won't get knocked out. He's like, no, my only chance is to hit this, to clock this guy good, just the once. Things start to turn in this fight, and you get this feeling that, like, lo and behold, he might be victorious here. And the way that it works out is, of course, he is. And now his manager and his trainer have fled. They've just left him in his corner. They've, like, well, he's in mid-bout. And so then the gangster, who's been ripped off in his view, is going to apply some muscle to the Robert Ryan character for payback. They don't even really care that he didn't know, if they even believe him. So what happens is they break his hand with a brick outside the arena. And it's just like, you don't see it. It kind of happens off stage. So it's still within, like, the visual line of the hotel. So he calls up to his wife as he's down on the ground. She sees him. He falls over. And she comes over, and they have this exchange that is marred. It's almost a perfect film, but I'd say it's marred by what she says. They give her the final line.
Yeah, and a little bit, I don't want to say cheesy, but it didn't need to be said.
Because he's going to a place in his dialogue, and so he's on the ground, in his hand, he'll never fight again, and like they're having this weepy moment, and it's very believable. But you know what he wants to say. Like, you're waiting for him to say, it's not predictable, but you know what he wants to say is he's just like this puddle on the ground. Finally, he says it, he goes, I won. I don't know. I think that it means something to him, and I think that's really what you want to have happen in a sports film. You want that idea of a victory to transcend what's going to happen in Game 3 between the Islanders and the Bruins. Do you know what I mean? Mm. You want the win beyond the win.
Right.
And I think that's the value that I've found in sports in my life, because they're not significant in and of themselves, but lessons that I learned in sport and playing sport and even watching sport is something I can apply to more important things. And you get the sense that he's going to now do that too in his own life. So he won in like a few different ways, really.
Well, if you get a chance to see it, it's on TCM fairly often. It's in the Criterion Collection, 1949's The Setup with Robert Ryan. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Some sad news over the weekend as we heard about the passing of an actor best known for his voice work, Paul Soles, who was, the voice of a character that I know has meant a lot to you through the years.
Indeed. In fact, he lives on, that character, in the form of Hallway Hermie. You know Hallway Hermie?
I do.
Hallway Hermie is the elf from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I was out last summer, I think it was, and I saw him in somebody's garbage sitting at the top. It was like dawn, and Hallway Hermie was like, can I come and live in your hallway? It's like, well, it's nicer than my actual apartment. Sure, that's fine. You can come back. And I took him, and I ran up the stairs with him because that's what I was on my way out to do, and he was in my pocket. He's like, oh, this is kind of fun. I'm like, yeah, great, whatever. I'm a very, very lonely man, Mr. Kimball. So I brought him back, and yes, I love the Rudolph special. In fact, I don't feel a need to only partake of Rudolph at Christmas. When I get to a happier place in life, I will be a guy who's firing up that Blu-ray on a day like June 1st. So he's 90 years old, Paul Soles. And I think the thing about Hermie, the character, and the way that Soles imbued that character too, was Hermie was the linchpin of that beloved special. Like, I don't have any friends myself right now, but I know of people who serve that purpose of bringing people together in healthy and productive ways. I guess Peppermint Patty is kind of an example in the Peanuts strips, once you get past, like, when she comes in and whenever it was, she wasn't in, like, the Christmas special or anything like that, but, like, later on, like, in the 70s. So I think, like, if you watch the Rudolph special, a bunch of months probably for most people, note the role that Hermie plays. He's, first of all, he's a pretty openly gay character. I don't think that's, like, especially subtle. So I'm sure that meant a lot to a lot of people at the time, in a different time, when it wasn't as favorable or comfortable or doable to perhaps be as one was or is. And so I think that's an important thing. I think very much the character was played that way, not in a kind of splashy way, not in like a cheap theatrical sort of for yucks kind of way, which you would get at the time. And Hermie's a very good friend to Rudolph. And also Yukon Cornelius. I like that scene when they get rejected by the lion guy and they're in this like cottage, which is actually kind of nice. And they're like all in this bed. And Hermie's the one who rallies them together. It's like, it's settled. Tomorrow we do this and we leave at daybreak. And he's like kind of not so much the leader, but the friend glue. And you need some friend glue, I think. And Hermie was very much that way in that special.
And apparently the only reason Paul Soles got the part is because Rankin and Bass were looking to save money at the time, and it was cheaper to use Canadian voice artists.
Huh, that's interesting. And it's funny, too, because if you look at that first special, the Rudolph one, the production values of that, the details, they're at a different level than their subsequent. Mm. I like them all, but they're like, there's a level of detail in that particular special that you can watch it over and over and over again. And you just notice these telling little things like, okay, here are these people talking in the foreground. And oh, look what this like little bird is doing back here with this tree in the background. You don't get that with the ones that come after. I mean, whether they're the animated ones or the animagic ones. But I just, yeah, it's a heartening, inspiring, plucky character. Stands up to a bully who stands up, and that head elf guy who stands up to, of course, the abominable snowman in the cave and the oink oink and all of that. And someone who's like willing to put down their own life for the betterment of their, for the survival of their friends. I remember watching this as a kid thinking like, that elf is like pretty cool. And it just goes to show too, it's cool to have a dream that isn't the dream that everyone else has. Like, people don't have dreams. I feel like they kind of like do what their parents did, or they fall into something because they have to pick something. But Hermie had a dream. He wanted to be a dentist. It was like a quirky, cool dream. And I always respected that a lot.
Yeah. Well, rest in peace, Paul Soles. Pretty good run making it to 90. I'll take that. We're talking with Colin Fleming. Let's move to a terrific album from Sam Cooke. And to me, what makes it a good album is the fact that the production gets out of the way and lets him shine on 1963's Nightbeat.
Sam Cooke could get lost a little bit in some of his recordings, and certainly his recordings prior to this one. He's near the end of his life. They could be, I don't want to say like schmaltzy, but Billie Holiday was the same way. Like, a lot of times if you listen to Billie Holiday, she's in a lot of mush, but sometimes it's quite spare and Spartan, and it's a small band. And this is a pretty small band for Sam Cooke. There aren't like a lot of lush strings, and it's not going symphonic and all of that. It was recorded late at night, and fittingly. So it's like a concept album of the night. I think it was like last week we spoke about Finnegan's Wake is kind of like a book of the night. Well, here is an album and some sessions that represent the nocturnal side of things. And it's an album meant to be listened to. You can listen to it whenever, obviously. But there's something a little bit different, wouldn't you say, when you're sitting there at 11, 12, 1 o'clock, whatever it is, listening to Sam Cooke sing Lost and Looking, than if it's like high noon.
Oh, yeah, it is most definitely mood music. And, yeah, I think it's got a different feel. The later you listen, the more alone you are, the better it is.
There's a few other albums like that. Otis Blue, is that way, by Otis Redding, and In the Wee Small Hours by Frank Sinatra.
Oh, yeah.
Very much in this. I mean, Cook, he doesn't write a lot of the numbers on this particular album. He gets a credit for arranging You Gotta Move, which people would know from Fred McDowell or the Rolling Stones, is the most famous version, probably from 1969. And then they took it on tour with him, too, after it was on Let It Bleed. But it's always with Cook, like we said, it's a concept album, and it's something that's meant to capture. Because when we say like mood music, it almost sounds like it's kind of this oral wallpaper. That's not what this is.
Oh, no.
This is like heavy-duty listening music. And F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote of the real dark night of the soul at 3 o'clock in the morning. And this is, again, that idea of soul, yes, soul music, but also italicize it, soul music. Mm. Because Sam Cooke is operating on both fronts. And so like this album, with that concept and with that mood and with that purpose of direction, plays a big part, actually, in my upcoming book on Live at the Harlem Square Club, which is night music, but it's like out there, joyous, all of this in Miami and that kind of thing. But they're linked in certain key ways. There's a progression here between these thematic ideas. And so I think, like, for the Cook connoisseur, this is one of the go-to albums. This is like one of the two or three. Mm. Harlem Square Club, I think, is like the most Cookian. But then, like, this one would probably be the number two. It captures the essence, and it was a wide-ranging essence, but it captures the essence of the man and the artist better than just about everything else.
And a great small group of musicians, including a guy we had on the show a few years back, the wonderful Hal Blaine from the Wrecking Crew. And I didn't realize until I was doing a little research over the weekend, a 16-year-old Billy Preston.
Yeah, that's in the book too. Billy Preston is like this organ prodigy, and he was really racking up the dates, the sessionography. Think of him as Tony Williams. I think we discussed him years ago, the drummer, the Wonderkind drummer who Miles Davis was so taken by. And he was 16 or 17 when Miles Davis said, you need to be in my second great quintet. And he was the guy who made that quintet go. And then you have this guy named Clifton White, who is Sam Cooke's right-hand musical man. He plays guitar, and he's this undersung guitar hero of popular music history. Nobody knows who he is. I mean, he's sort of one of the heroes of this Sam Cooke book that I did. And he's this very rhythmic player. You might think of him as like a soul Pete Townsend. Pete Townsend played lead guitar via rhythm guitar, if that makes sense. And that's the same kind of deal that we're working with here. But it was always in tandem with Cook's voice. And Cook would use his voice. Again, the great singers do this. Billie Holiday did this. Very horn-like, her voice. He used his voice as a succession of other instruments that we don't think of as vocal, but he was channeling those as well.
Well, speaking of guitarists, you wrote a recent Jazz Times piece on Charlie Christian and his performance, live performance from 1941 at Minton's, which is just incredible to listen to. And well, you say it may be jazz's greatest official bootleg.
1941, so that's going back 80 years now. It's from May, and I think, like, if people are considering what instruments best represent jazz, they're not thinking guitar. They're going right away to the saxophone and the trumpet and those kinds of things, and the drums and the voice, and maybe even the bass. Like, I don't think the guitar, the organ, the guitar doesn't come up perhaps as much, and we don't really think of bebop as a guitar medium. But that's what was happening at this place, this Harlem club, Minton. So it's after hours, and it's live in a sense. It's more of a field recording, which is a bit different than a live recording. So you have these guys, they're just showing up. They're pooling together. They've come from wherever they've come in the city. and they're getting together to jam. What's happening in this crucible of Minkins is that they're largely inventing the bebop medium. But one of the spearheads of that medium is Charlie Christian on guitar. He's just knocking people out with what he's playing. And it's just this nuts, razzle-dazzle, but still tasteful sort of scalar runs. And no one was playing like this at the time. And so somebody has a little tape recorder deal, has actually probably a big tape recorder, and hit record, and there you go. These recordings have come out in various formats over the years, but you can imagine yourself, again, that idea of night music, because these same people are making this music. You think about it like 20-plus years later, it's like, oh, that's Sam Cooke. He's doing his kind of mood music version of what we were doing. But Charlie Christian asserts himself as this guy inventing bebop almost as much as Charlie Parker or Dizzy Gillespie.
And as you point out in the Jazz Times piece, Colin, the tone that he achieves is so unique.
Yeah, I think what I compared it to or likened it to was honey dripping down the inside of an abalone shell. It's like that kind of viscosity, but viscosity with sheen. So not like sluggish viscosity, some viscosity that can move like oil for your car type of thing. It gets the wheels turning. So you recognize the best players, the best writers. And it doesn't have to be the same tone, but somebody can just like hit a certain lick or a clause, and it can be mixed up from time to time, completely different than the time before. But you always know it's them. And I think, like, if you don't have that, you're really not a great artist. You're not a great musician. And Charlie Christian certainly had that in spades.
In another recent Jazz Times piece, you celebrate a great solo performance by a multi-instrumentalist, but doing the bass clarinet so proud on God Bless the Child, Eric Dolphy. And again, you call him a glue guy, the sports equivalent, the music equivalent of a sports glue guy. What do you mean by that?
I think Eric Dolphy might be the most significant modern jazz player in history, in his way, more significant than Ornette Coleman or Miles Davis, sort of spanned a few different eras, but more significant than John Coltrane. I think Eric Dolphy was the guy that Coltrane wanted to hang out with to bounce ideas off of. He was the wise, owlish figure. And he died, he was only in his mid-30s, so he's not actually going to live that long into the whole, like, he's not there in 1965, but he's doing what he's doing with Coltrane sitting in 1961, and he was this sorcerer, and he's playing alto sax, and he's walking this line between free jazz, post-bop, and commercial jazz. And he's showing up at all of these sessions, like Ornette Coleman's doing his free jazz recording, and lo and behold, there is Eric Dolphy. He just was always around when change was happening, and when something like that, like a Soviet coach said about Wayne Gretzky once, like the guy does, it looks like he's doing nothing, and then like 20 seconds later, boom, the puck is in the net, and it's like he's somehow responsible for this, but you don't even understand how. Eric Dolphy was that way. So what he did a number of times in his career was he took the bass clarinet, which would seem like an unwieldy jazz instrument, and he did this solo version of Billie Holiday's God Bless the Child. And to blow everyone's mind with how harmonically advanced this was, you cannot even transcribe this piece of music. I mean, think about that. You can't notate this piece of music, I mean, across any of the versions. So he did a version of it at the Five Spot Cafe in July 1961 with Booker Little, who was his sort of like right-hand man, great trumpet player. And Booker Little is going to die later in 1961. Dolphy's going to die not that long after. And so it's like this sort of horribly tragic set of circumstances. But man, live jazz is probably never been better than those particular gigs at the Five Spot. It came out, and you can go check it out on YouTube and stuff too. But the highlight for me was always this unaccompanied version of God Bless the Child. I mean, there's nothing like it in musicdom, period. Like, there's really no comparison I can even make to it. You could say, like, well, Anthony Braxton, like, for alto, it's just him and alto sax for the entire, like, double disc. But no, there's really nothing like what Dolphy did with this particular Billie Holiday number.
No, and I had no idea about how his life ended and the fact that he died basically from diabetes, undiagnosed, in Europe, because they just assumed, because he was a black jazz musician, they assumed he was strung out on drugs.
Well, when someone is like star-crossed and they die, and Booker Little didn't die of drugs either, it's like uremia, that tends to be what it is. And it's not a black thing. It's certainly plenty of white jazz musicians at the time. It was the culture. It was a dope culture. Like, very few people in jazz were not on, like, heroin at some point. Some kicked it, like Coltrane, but it took a toll in selling Coltrane before his time. He was a young man still. But what I'm going to do eventually is I'm going to write a novel with kind of Eric Dolphy as the basis, and it's going to be about this African-American musical pioneer who's in that time period of the civil rights movement and free jazz and the new thing, and tell it via, like, interviews and record reviews and diary entries and all that. And you can use his story as the basis for a quite different story, but like rooted in that particular time period. It's like no one's ever done that. So he's always been a character to me that I've sort of had like this eye on, like the way one looks at this particular, like, Polaris in the sky. It's like, yes, we will eventually have our little date, our union. So yeah, great stuff, Eric Dolphy.
I look forward to it. Check out Colin's pieces on Jazz Times, and of course, visit the website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well. Colin, we thank you. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.